Okay, we're going to start here about halfway down the daf on Lamed Daled Amud Bet. We have a statement of Rav Huna. Amar Rav Huna, Mashbino Toshva Sheina Bershuto, that the Shomer here, this is coming, or he's Rav Huna is commenting on our Mishnah that said that the Shomer has a choice, that he can either take a Shvua and be poter himself, or if he chooses to not take the Shvua and pay for it, we allow him to pay for the item, and then he takes possession of the item or any benefits that would come from that item. So Rav Huna says that even when he does pay it, we still make him take an additional shvuah, which is shvuah she'ena b'rishuto, that's not his possession. My daimo, why do we do that? Chashinu shemen einav natan ba, because we're afraid that maybe he liked the item. He decided that he liked the object and he wanted to purchase it. So his way of purchasing it is to say it was stolen. Then he pays the money to Balim, so he doesn't feel guilty because he's paid for it. And then he'll keep it. So what we want to ensure here is that the actual item is actually lost or stolen, and that's the reason that he's paying here, not because he really decided that he wants to keep this object. So now we're going to have a brace so that is questioning this position of Rav Huna. Someone lends money with collateral, and then the creditor loses the collateral that he took, and he says to the debtor, alav, I lent you a sela, shekel hayashave, but the collateral that you gave to me was worth only half a sela. It was only worth half the amount of the loan. V'halaomer, and the debtor responds to him and says, lo, ki ela sela hivitani alav, sela yashave. He says, no, you lent me a sela, the mashkon was worth a sela, and now I owe you nothing. Then he is patur. He's patur over here because he's basically a kofer bakom, that he is not being modem mixat at all. Right now, the creditor says, you owe me a shekel, you owe me a half sela, and the debtor says, I owe you nothing. In this next case, sela hilviticha lav, shekel hayashaveh. Again, the creditor makes a claim that I lent you a sela, and the mashkon that you give me is worth a shekel, meaning only worth half a sela. Vahala omer, and then the debtor responds and says, lo, ki ela sela hivitana, you're right, you lent me a sela, alav, shlosha dirinim hayashaveh. That, the other hand, it was worth 3 dinar, there are 4 dinar in a sela. So basically, he is saying that I chayav to you a quarter of a sela. There is chayav because he's modem b'miksat. The creditor is saying, look, I lent you a sela, the mashkon was worth a shekel, you owe me half a sela. And the response of the debtor is, no, I only owe you a quarter of a sela, because the mashkon was worth 3 denarim and not 2 denarim, as you say. So here he's modem miksat, because he says, yes, I owe you a quarter, but I don't owe you the other quarter. That's the case of modem miksat, he's chayav to take a shvuah. Sela vitani alav, bet hayashaveh. Now, if the debtor is the one who's making the claim here, he says, listen, you lent me a sela, and it's really worth, the mashkon that you lost was worth 2 sela. V'alomer lo, and the creditor responds to the debtor and says, lo, ki ela sela v'tichila alav, sela yashaveh. He says, no, I lent you a sela, the mashkon was worth a sela, patur, here is patur, because he's claiming I owe you nothing. Right now the debtor is claiming that the creditor owes him a sela, because the mashkon was in excess of the loan, and the creditor is responding and saying, I owe you nothing. So he's a kofer bakol, he's patur min hashvua. The other hand, if the debtor makes a claim, seva yitani ala v'shnai mayashavet, that it was, you lent me a sela, and the mashkon was worth 2 sela, so therefore you owe me a sela. V'la omer, and the creditor says, lo, ki ela sela yiviticha, you're right, I did lend you a sela, alav, hey dinarim hayashaveh. On the other hand, the mashkon itself was worth 5 dinarim, and it was worth in excess of a sela. So over here we have a modeh b'miksat case, because the debtor is making a claim that the creditor owes him a sela, and the creditor is responding and saying, no, I don't owe you a full sela, I only owe you 3/4 of a sela. So again, that's a case of modeh miksat, therefore chayav, he must take a shvuah, the creditor in this instance. Mi nishba, Bereza clarifies, who takes a shvuah here? Mi shepikadon etzlo, whoever is in possession of the pikadon. Shema, why do we want the person who's holding the pikadon to take the shvuah? Shema yishba zeh, yotzi hala to pikadon, because we don't want the other party who's not in control of the object taking the shvuah, and all of a sudden the other individual who has control of the object pulls it out and says, ha, here it is. Right? If he says, here it is, then he could disprove what the claim of the person who just took a shvuah. So the Rashi says, the problem here is that we're afraid that Shemif Salenu, or make him into a Rasha, make him Pasul to take shvuot, because he will take a shvuah, and then the other individual will take out the mashkon and show and prove to him that he was wrong about it. The Rabbeinu Chanan, on the other hand, explains that the fear here is not that he'll take it out and be Pusel the individual posel, the debtor who is taking a shua here, because he says, why would we make a takana to protect Rishayim? I mean, if he's going to swear falsely, then why do we care that the other person pulls it out and is posel him? If he's wrong, then let's prove that he's wrong. Rather, Menu Chanel says that the fear here is that it's an unnecessary shua. We're going to force the debtor to take a shua, and then the creditor will pull out the mashkon, and then he would have, the debtor really never had to take the shua because he has the object. And now it's what's the problem. It's we don't want the debtor to have to take an unnecessary shua because that is not nice for them. It's not appropriate. So, hi. This statement about who takes the shua, on what part of the brisa is going? If it's going on the second half of the brisa, but typically the shua gabe malfi. Why do you have to worry at all? The claimant here, the person who is bringing the litigation to court, is the debtor. And the defendant is the creditor. If the creditor is the defendant, he's the one who's going to take the shua anyway. So he's the one who had the mashkon. He's the one taking the shua. Why do I have to have any sort of takana? Because he is modi b'miksa, and that's why he's taking shua. Ela, amar Shmuel, aresha. It's going on the first half of the Mishnah. The first half of the Mishnah is my aresha. When we say the first half of the Mishnah, we mean a sefer deresha on the second half of the first part of the resha. In the first case of the brisa, we said that the debtor does not have to take a shua at all because he's kofer bakol. He says, I owe you nothing. In the second case, where the creditor made a claim and says that the mashkon was only worth half of the loan and you owe me a half selah, and the debtor responds and says, no, it was worth three quarters of a selah, I only owe you a quarter of a selah, that's a modim mixat. The lovesh should be the one to take the shua. So because he should have taken the shua, we say over here, this kas chachamim is flip the shua over to the malveh. Selah yiviticha lev, shekla yashavet. It was worth only half a selah. V'hama omer lo, kela selah yivitani lev, shosha derima yashavet. No, that it was worth, the loan was for a selah, and the collateral was only worth three quarters of a selah. Chayav, you're chayav, because your modim mixat. In this case, who should be taking the shua? The debtor, because the claim is against the debtor. He's the defendant. He's the one who should take the shua as a modu miksat, right? Who? Rabbanan, and the Rabbanan are talking over here. The Chachamim are talking that we flip the shua onto the malveh. Tell the malveh to take the shua in order that we don't have this problem, that the possibility that the loveh will take or the debtor will take the shua, and the creditor will pull out the mashkon, and either according to Rashi, prove him to be a liar, or going to Rinachana, make it an unnecessary fact that he needed to take a shua over here. Where it says, Vim ito de Rav Huna. Now, this is the question, this whole braisa that we just discussed. Now, this is the question on Rav Huna's statement. If we hold like Rav Huna, came in de mishtaba malva shene b'shuto, hei chematzi mapikla. According to Rav Huna, there's an obligation upon anybody who's a shomer to take a shua that they do not have the item in their possession. Over here, it's clear that the Gemara's only Rashi points this out, that this Tana holds that a Malve ala Mashkon is a Shomer Sachar, that he's classified as a Shomer Sachar. When you are holding collateral for a loan, you become like a Shomer Sachar for it. So over here too, if he's a Shomer Sachar, he makes a claim that it was lost, and technically he'll have to pay for it, but the paying for it is in the offset to the loan that he made. But nevertheless, because he's a Shomer, we say he must take a Shua according to Rav Huna to say that it's Eino B'Shuto. Now, if the Malva takes a Shua that it's Eino B'Shuto, then why are we worried about the Loveh, the debtor, taking a Shua now? The Malva can never take out the item anymore because he took a Shua that it doesn't exist or that's no longer with him. And we assume, we're not dealing with Rishayim over here, he might pull it out after he might say that it was lost and then pull it out when the Loveh takes a Shua, but on the other hand, he wouldn't take a Shua himself and then pull it out afterwards to disprove himself. So we assume if he took the Shua that he's not going to pull it out. So I'm a Rava. Rava suggests the first answer over here. Otherwise, I'm a Rava. There were Edim that it was burnt up, that it was no longer there. Mark says, if we have Edim that it disappeared, it was consumed, then there's no possibility that the Malveh is going to pull out the Mashkon anymore because it doesn't exist. So that can't be the solution here. Elamar of Yosef. Yosef presents us with the first solution to this Braisa to reconcile between Rav Huna and the Braisa, which is, we have Edim that it was stolen. So now, sof, mehechi maitla. If it was stolen, then how's the Malveh going to pull it out? We have Edim that says it's stolen. How are we going to have now somebody come here and pull out the item, the mashkon? It says the tarachu maitila, that he'll go and find it. I mean that the malveh will go and search out and find the mashkon, the ganav. He'll bring it back and he'll be able to pull it out on the loveh. Why don't we have the same fear? That when the Malva himself takes the Shua, we flipped it onto the Malva to take the Shua here. Why don't we have the same fear that the Love will go out, find the object, find the Gneva, and then pull it out after the Malva has taken the Shua? Where it says, Bishlama Malva Yodo Mandkar Benofik Bebeite. It comes to the Malva knows who goes in and out of his house. So he knows who to chase after, he knows who to go find, or how to get the object back. There's a possibility, or a distinct possibility, he could find the Ganav and bring it back. The Love is missing a key part of the information, which is he has no idea who goes in and out of the house of the Malve. He doesn't know enough information to go out and then bring back the object or get the stolen object back. So because of that, we flip the Shua, according to Rav Yosef, from the Love onto the Malve. So to reconcile over here, Rav Yosef says Rav Huna's din is true, that a Shomer will take a Shua when he has to pay, he will take a Shua that's Eino B'Shuto. Why in our case of the Brisa does he not have to take a Shua Sheino B'Shuto? Is because we have a Edim here testifying that it was Nignav. In that case, we know for certain that it was taken, and it's not a problem that Shema Natan Einav Ba'am. We're not worried about the fact that the Malve here decided he liked this Mashkoni, wants to keep it, because we have a Edim that it was stolen. So if that's the case, when we come to taking the Shua and the Braisa, we say flip the Shua over to the Malve. It says, why flip it? If they're Gnevim that it was Nignav, then it's not around anymore. What are we worried about the Malve pulling it out? Rav says, no, that the Malve will pull it out, he'll go find the Gneva and he'll pull it out. It says, that's the case, we should have the Chashash both ways. Even the Love himself, we should worry about. And the Gemara says, no, there's a difference between the Love and the Malve. The Malve has the ability or an information or evidence to go and search it out and bring back the Gneva. The Love is missing key pieces of information to bring it back, and therefore it's unlikely that he would bring it back. And so if we flip the Shua from the Love to the Malve, that's one solution. Abaye brings us a new solution. Abaye Omer, Gzeira Shemi Iton, V'yomalar Achar Shua Mitzatia. Now, truthfully, they do take the Shua of Rav Huna over here. So if they take the Shua of Rav Huna, how come we're worried about him pulling it out? What could say like that? He can make a claim like this to Malva. Malva says, I take a Shua that it was lost, that it's not in my Peshuti. Later on, he's cleaning for Pesach, and all of a sudden he finds it, and he pulls it out. He says, oh, I did find it, but I found it after I took the Shua. When I took the Shua, I was telling the truth. I really had no idea where it was. Now that I found it, I'm going to take it out. So we're afraid that the Malva can still pull it out. Even if he takes a Shua, Shein Peshuti, right, we can still pull it out, because maybe later on he'll find it and then take it out. Rav Ashi offers a third explanation, reconciliation between Rav Huna and the Braisa. Rav Ashi Amar, Zenishpa v'Zenishpa. You know, Chanami, Rav Huna's right, and they both take Shavuot over here. Both the Malva and the Lova takes a Shua. The Malva takes a Shua Sheinu B'Shuti, because he's the Shomer over the Mashkon, and the Lova will take a Shua as to the value of the Mashkon. Zenishpa Sheinu B'Shuto, v'Zenishpa Kama Yeshav. The Malva takes the Shua that it's not in his possession, and the Lova takes a Shua that it's how much it was worth. Vachi Kamar. Mi nishbat chila. The question that the Brisa is addressing is not who takes the Shua, but rather who takes the Shua first. Malve nishbat chila, shema yishbazev yotzi ala et hapikadon. And the answer is that the Malve will take the Shua first of Sheinu B'Shuti in order to prevent us from running into a situation where the Love will take a Shua about the value and then the Malve pulls it out. So what we do is we insist that the Malve takes his Shua first at Sheinu B'Shuti, so then we don't have to worry about the fact that he's going to pull it out. And on the other hand, the Love does not have to worry now that he will pull it out, and the Love will take the Shua. We don't flip the Shua to the Malve, rather the Shua remains with the Love. We just insist that the Malve takes the Shua beforehand. So now we have three opinions on how to reconcile Rav Huna with the Braisa. There is Rav Yosef, who says Rav Huna is not Shayach here because we have Edim that was Nignav, right? And the possibility of the Malve taking it out is because he'll search it out and get it. Then we have the positions of Abaye and Rav Ashi, who both say that the Shua of Rav Huna does exist here and there is being taken here. Rav Abaye's solution is to say that the Shua was taken, but afterwards the Malva found it and they brought it out. Rashi's position is, no, that the Malva takes the Shua, the Lova takes the Shua, there's no flipping the Shua to the Malva. The only question that the Braisa is dealing with is who takes the Shua first. And that's the answer of the Braisa, that we flip to the Malva, not we flip the Lova Shua to the Miser, but we flip to the Malva to say, you take a Shua first, that's Sheinu B'Shuto. Now, Rav Huna bar Tchlifa Mishmei de Rav Amar, Reisha de Seifa Tiyufta de Rav Huna, that the first case in the second half of the Braisa is really a problem for Rav Huna. That's a case of Kofar Bakol, a case where the debtor is making a claim that the collateral was worth more than the loan, and that the creditor actually owes him money. And the creditor responds that they were equal and I owe you no money. Now, according to Rav Huna says that in that case you will still take a Shavua. You'll take a Shavata Shomrim that Eino B'Shuti, that it's not in my possession. Now, if in this case, the debtor makes a claim that you lent me a sela and my mashkon was worth two sela, so you owe me a sela. Alo mer lo kiel a sela v'iticha. You're right, I lent you a sela. Alav sela yeshaveh. Patur, that, and it was only worth a sela. Patur, there is no need for shuah because it's a kovar bakol. V'me'ito the Rav Huna, if we really hold of Rav Huna, migo dimishtaba malve she'enu bishuto, if the malve himself is going to take a shuah that's enu bishuto, ishtaba nami agilgul shuah kama haya shaveh, then he should take a shvuah that how much it's worth. Now this is according to the two answers that we gave according to Baye and Rav Ashi, who said that we do, or Rav Huna, according to Rav Huna, we're taking a shvuah in this case over here. If that's the situation, then why not force him to do gilgul shvuah, to force him to take? If he's already taking a shvuah that's enu b'shuti, let us force him to take a shvuah about the worth of the value of the mashkon over here. So it can't be that Rav Huna is right, otherwise he would have gilgul shvuah, and even though he's called for bakol, he's put for a shvuah mitar mitzad Mikdud Mixas or Kofar Kol, but he should be Chayv Mitzad Shvuah because he's taking Shvuah anyway of Shenu B'Shuti. So let's just roll into that or add on to that the Shvuah of how much is worth. Amar Rashi Amrita the Shmaita Kamei Rav Kahana. Let's set up this case in a case where he trusts him, meaning that the loved, the debtor, trusts the creditor to say that it's not in my possession. If he says it's not with me, it's been stolen, it's been taken, it's not in my possession, he doesn't have to take a shvuah because the loved, the debtor, believes him. Mar says, if that's the case, right? If that's the case, why don't we say that if the loved is trusting this malve, he's trusting this creditor about the mashkon, let him say, come have a shavu, look. Why don't we also believe him in the second case of this, of the seifa? In the case where he is motive mixat, why should he have to take a shvuah about the value of the mashkon? In that case, we could say, listen, the loved trusts him, why should he have to take a shvuah? So when it says, lo kim lebe kave, he doesn't know the value of the mashkon. It's not the debtor whose mashkon it was knows it well, and therefore he knows the value of the malve, just took it as collateral for his loan, but he doesn't know it so well. So when it says, if that's the case, let's go back to the Reisha case, and let's say that the malve believes the love when it comes to the value of the mashkon. If the love knows the mashkon so well, he knows the value, why don't we say that the malve trust the creditor will trust the debtor in this case to say how much the value of the mashkon is. If we're saying in the second half of the brisa, that's a case where the debtor trusts the creditor, why don't we set up the first case, or the ratio of that brisa, to say what's the creditor trusting the debtor? It says, no. Why do we now have a difference between the malve and the love? The creditor does not trust the debtor, but the debtor does trust the creditor. Why would we have such an imbalance? Gemara says that's love mekayim be malve. The love views the malve in a certain context. That is tumat yisharim tanchim. The pasuk in Mishlei tells us that the innocence of the just will guide them, or basically that the only way that Hashem is rewarding this individual with wealth or the ability to lend here, because he must be a good person. If he's a good person, he's, you know, a person must be a person of good midot, of stature and trustworthiness. That's why Hashem entrusted him with wealth. If that's the case, then I also trust him. I trust him to do the right thing, and I trust take care to trust him to tell me that if he lost it, then I believe him. On the other hand, Malve Mekayim Bebelov, the Malve looks at Lov and says, no, because this is the end of the same pasuk in Mishlei. The Selef Bogdim Yishadim. When it comes to the corruption of the faithless or those that rebel, Yishadim, that will destroy them or despoil them. So if that's the case, the Malve looks at the Loveh and says the Loveh needs to borrow money. Borrowing money, and he's in a situation where he needs to borrow money and things are difficult for him, that must be an indication that there's something wrong. There's not something, he's not so perfect, or there's some question about his midot, and therefore I won't trust him. This is very true of Eastern cultures in general, that viewing that people who do succeed and who have wealth are considered to be blessed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, in the sense that they're blessed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu because they've done something good or right, and therefore Hashem blesses them. And those that need to borrow, taking on debt was considered to be taboo, unless one is absolutely necessary. People didn't necessarily take debt just to borrow like we do today in Western civilization to buy houses and to do business, but rather debt was considered to be taboo. And if one took debt, it was already must have been that the person was in straits that he needed to take, or dire straits that he needed to take debt. If that's the case, viewed him that the need to borrow was an indication that this person's situation had deteriorated because of his behavior. There was a similar Gemara, just mentioned it here in Erevin and Daf Pehei, that there the Gemara disguises about Rebbe and Rebbe Akiva that they used to be omid lifnei ashirim. They used to stand up when the rich people came in to speak to them. They used to stand up for them. Again, the same concept or same idea that the reason that they Hashem will only bless them to be rich because of something special about them. If that's the case, then it's only appropriate that we stand up for the ashirim when they walk in. Now, Gemara continues with a new case. Ho gavro da afkid kipe gabe de chavre. He gave earrings over to his friend to watch for him. He had a bunch of earrings that he gave over to his friend to watch. Amalei, so it came time. Amalei, havalei kipe. Says, give me back my earrings, meaning that I'd like them back. Amalei, lo yudana hecho tvinu. I don't know where they are. I don't know where I placed them down. So after they come to Rav Nachman, they brought the case before the Dayan Rav Nachman. Amalei, kol yudana pshuta. If you say you don't know where it is, that's equivalent to being poshe in the davar. The fact that you don't know where it is indicates that you were not shomeret, you were not guarding it or taking care of it properly. If you don't know where it is, that's a pshia. Pshia, you're chayev to pay. So, zil shlim. He says, go pay him. Pay him back for the item. Lo shilim. The shomer here refused to pay, or he didn't listen to the psak din of Rav Nachman. Azo Rav Nachman agrila pan de mine. Nachman went ahead and took his house, seized property from him in order to pay back the individual who lost his earrings over here. Sofi shtakach kipe. In the end, they found the earrings viyakar. And the value of the earrings had gone up. Meaning that they happened to be mele, meaning that the market price of the earrings had gone up in value. So at this point, the person who had been mafkid the earrings over there is in a bad position. He's in a bad position because he really wanted the earrings back because the earrings now are worth more money. But in the interim, Rav Nachman had seized the property of the shomer and given him compensation for it, so he really doesn't owe him anything more. So now, v'yakar, Amar Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman says, Hadar kipe le marayu, return the earrings to the original owner, v'hadra panto le mara, and you'll get your house back. So Rav Nachman says it forces him to return the house and return the earrings. So Amar Rav, Rav was sitting there at the time of Yatvina Kameda Rav Nachman. I was sitting in front of Rav Nachman. He gave this Pesach Alachu, Pirkin Amafkid Avo. We also happened to be learning the Perik of Amafkid. So I said, Amilei, and I asked him the question, Shilim Velo Ratzali Shava, our Mishnah here at the beginning of Amafkid, it says that if the Shomer makes a decision not to take the shvuah to be poter himself, but rather to pay. And then it says where he pays, he becomes the owner of the item, and he gets all the upside. He gets the kefil. He gets the kefil if the ganav is found. So why don't we say the same thing here? In this instance, he chose not to take a shvuah. He wasn't able to take a shvuah, but he paid the money. So once he pays the money, he should become the owner of the item. And if they went up in value, the earrings, they should belong to the shomer now because he's paid full value. He's compensated the balim for their loss. And now everything should be a closed case. So he says, if that's the case, why isn't that equivalent to our Mishnah? And he didn't respond to me. Rav Nachman didn't respond to Rava. And then Rava says, it's a good thing that he didn't answer me, or he was right in not answering me, my time up, because the cases are totally different. Because over there, he didn't force him to go to Beis Din. I mean, he did take him to Beis Din in order to have the Shvuah taken into pay. But over there, the individual acquiesces to do whatever he's told. Either he takes the Shvuah, or he says, I'm not going to take a Shvuah, I'm going to pay you. And then he pays. Or if he said, I'm going to take a Shvuah, and then later decides he's going to pay him, according to Rav, who says you could do that. In all those cases, he does what he says he's going to do. He pays him. He compensates the balim. There's no need to seize his property in order to get paid. Over here, this individual caused the Beis Din Rav Nachman to go out of the way to have to seize his property, to sell the property, to make whole, to or give back the money to the person who was deserving of the money. So the fact that he was Achachel Beis Din, we say that the sale is not complete. Lememra. So in this we conclude the Sover of Nachman, the Shuma Hadar. Then in cases where we seize property on behalf of a, for instance, creditor, that it would go back. If the debtor had no money to pay, and then Beis Din writes a seizure document that the creditor can now come and seize property from the debtor wherever it is to pay for the loan, and he goes in and he seizes it. Now, do you have a right in that instance to buy the property back? So, say the debtor later on comes into money, can he pay the malva off and say, the creditor off and say, listen, I paid you your money back, I really want my property back. Can he say that? Or do we say once the property is given and seized, that it's a done deal and you can't reverse it? So it sounds like from Nachman over here that you are allowed to reverse such a case, because the case of a malva a little bit will be similar to the case over here, where we're Achachei Beis Din, we forced the Beis Din to go ahead and seize the property and sell it and give it to the creditor. If that's the case, then why should it be Hadar? Why should it go back, right? Unless Rav Nachman believes that you can replace or you can return the property. Where it says, Hashani Hatam Deshuma B'Tautava. Our case over here by the earrings is totally different. By the case of the creditor and the debtor being obligated is obligated to pay the money back. When we assess his property and seize it, we are rightfully seizing the property because he has no money to pay it back. If he comes into money later, That's not relevant to the time that we did the assessment of his property and we sold it or we gave it to the creditor. On the other hand, over here in our case, the only reason that we seized the property of the shomer is because we thought he didn't have the earrings. But when we find out he had the earrings, that means that he had the earrings all along. Right, true, at the time that we seized the property, we didn't know about them, but they were present and they were available. And therefore, the whole seizure here was done, the teilut was done by mistake, and that's why we're reversing it. Normally, we wouldn't reverse such a seizure, but here we're reversing the seizure because there was a mistake. To have a kippah, meyakara, because the earrings were always present. He didn't know about them, or he thought they were lost, or he didn't know where they were, but nevertheless, they were always present, and therefore, the assessment here was done by mistake. So Amrei Naradai, this is a gemara that we saw earlier, Shuma Hadar Atresa Yar Cheshato, that up to 12 months, seized property is returned to the original owner, meaning that it was used to pay off the creditor. The debtor can come back within the first 12 months and give him the money and then get his property back. I'm from Narada. I'm sorry that I believe that you can return it forever. You're always allowed to return it. If the debtor gets his money and then gives it to the creditor, he can get his property back. The halacha is that's the case, that shuma always is returned, that when property is seized from the debtor on behalf of the creditor and given to the creditor, if the debtor then comes into money later on, he can return the money to the creditor and get his property back. But that's not Mikar Din. That's only Mishum Shnemer Vasita Yashar V'atov. That's the right thing to do. It's the right thing for the creditor to return the property, because the creditor was not really interested in the property. He was interested in getting his money back. He lent money. He was interested in getting the money back. Because there was no money, he took the property. So now, when he took the property, that wasn't his first thought, and that's what he did, not what he intended. And so if that's the case, when the debtor comes into money, is able to repay him, and he gets back what he really thought he was going to get back, then we ask him to return the property to the debtor, not because Mikar Din, he has to do it, because it's a real sale. The mechira is a full mechira here. The seizure is a full seizure. He does not have to return it, but rather, the reason that he is able to, or we ask of him to do this, because Sita Yashar V'atov, to do the right thing, to do the right thing and respond and give back to the property to the debtor. So now the Gemara says, Pshita. We know for certain, Shemolei the Balchov, Vazaliyu v'shem the Balchov. So in the case here, where we seize property from a debtor and give it to a creditor. But this creditor is also a debtor to another creditor. So it's almost like there are two creditors. Reuven's a creditor, Shimon's a creditor, and he lent to Levi. So Levi now has no money to repay Shimon, so the court goes and seizes the property from Levi to give to Shimon. Now Shimon also owes money to Reuven, and since, it seems like, since Levi didn't give him money, he's unable to pay back Reuven, and therefore, Reuven now comes and seizes the property that was seized from Levi to give to Shimon, and now we give it over to Reuven. So in that case, we say that it's clear to us that meaningly, lo adif at mikavrad at mine, that we say to Reuven, you're no better as a creditor, you're no better than the creditor Shimon himself. And if we demand of Shimon to return the property over here to the debtor if he has money, so to here we will ask of you, if the Levi shows up with the money, the debtor shows up with the money, that we'll ask you, Reuven, to return his property. Why? Because Levi will give the money to Shimon, and then Shimon will be obligated to give back. Shimon will give the money to Reuven, and Reuven will be obligated to give it to Shimon, who will give it to Levi. Meaning that in a transitive sense, or transitive property, here Levi can really enter with Reuven and say, listen, you're really trying to get money back. The fact that you have my property now is only because nobody had any cash. Now that I have cash, take the cash that's yours and give me back the property. But see, Yashar V'tov, do the right thing over here. Again, not obligated, but do the right thing. On the other hand, Zavno, if the creditor then sold the property, or Urta, it sounds here that he was Yorashit, that he gave it over as Yerusha to someone else, or not gave it, but he passed away and he gave it, it became a Yerusha, or Viava B'maton, he gave it as a gift to another individual, that's clear that these third parties now that are getting involved with the property are looking at the property as property and not as money. Meaning that the reason a person came and purchased the property from the creditor is because he wanted the property. He didn't want cash. So in that instance, it's clear to us that the debtor can't come back to the buyer now and say, listen, I have cash, give me back the property. Because he wasn't looking for cash. The creditor was looking for cash, but the buyer here was looking for the property. When he bought the property, that's what he assumed. He's going to keep the property, and therefore we will not demand of him to give it back, even because of Yassit Yashar V'tov. And the same is true of a Yoresh and the recipient of a gift. All of these individuals are expecting property, and they got the property. They're not expecting to get cash. And therefore, when the debtor comes into money, we don't insist that when he can pay them the cash, that they give the property back. Now, Baal, B'nichse Ishto, Lokeach Havi. So when it comes to a Baal in the property of his wife, he's considered to be a buyer and not a Yoresh. So again, with property of a woman can bring in two types of property into a marriage. You can bring in Nichsei Malug and Nichsei Toner Barzel. It's clear by Nichsei Toner Barzel, where she gives over the property to be assessed in value, and then the husband owes her that money if there's a divorce, or if he predeceases her, she can collect it through her ktubah. On the other hand, if the woman predeceases the husband, then that property goes to or is given as Yerusha to the husband. But even Nichsei Malug, the same thing is true. Even when the woman brings in property where the principal remains hers in the property, and the Baalim, the Baal, her husband is entitled to get the peirot or the leasehold in the property. He's entitled to get the output from this property. In both those instances, if the woman predeceases the husband, he keeps the property. Whether it's Son of Bazel or Nichsei Malug, he keeps it because he's the Yoresh of his wife. The Gemara says here that as the Yoresh of his wife, he's classified as a lokeach. He's classified as a buyer and not as a true yoresh, as a true inheritor. And what that has implications in the sect of lomi hader v'lo madrin and lay. That have implications in both directions, which means if shamul alisha, if we assess property for the woman, v'intzibah, meaning that she's a creditor, and we assess property, the debtor was unable to pay her, and we gave her property, and then she marries a husband. When she marries us, she brings this property into the marriage, and then she predeceases her husband, and the husband now takes the property. He's classified as a lokeach, as a buyer of the property, and therefore we will not obligate him to return that property to the debtor, because he's like a buyer of the property is focused on the property, not on the money. On the other hand, if the woman was a debtor, and then we assessed, before she got married, we assessed the property. The Beis Din came and seized the property from this woman and gave it to the creditor. So the woman's entitled then, if she comes into money, to go ahead and buy it back from the creditor, because it's her property. That would be a Sitei Asherato. But now the husband marries, and when the husband's married to her, she predeceases him, and now he's the inheritor of all of her rights and her property. So over here, he says, oh, let me go redeem that property that my wife could have redeemed. Let me stand in her shoes. So Gemara says again, no, the Baal is a lokeach. The Baal is classified here as a buyer and not as a yorish. And is that the case? As a lokeach, he has no rights. He can't step into the shoes of the woman in order to go buy back the property. So that's what we say over here. The Gemara says, in that case, because the Baal is classified as a lokeach, we don't force him either to give the property back, or we don't allow him to take back the property on behalf of the woman. And how do I know that the Baal is a lokeach? The Amar of Yosi, Rabbi Chinna, Ba'ushit Kino, Aisha Shemachra B'Nichsei Malug, a woman who sells her Nichsei Malug. Again, Nichsei Malug, we said, is where the principal belongs to the woman, and the output or the leasehold on the property belongs to the husband. He's able to take the output, the pirot of this property. Now, what can the woman do? If she owns the principal, she can sell the principal out from under her husband. She could sell the property. Now, while her husband's still alive and while she's still alive, the property will remain in the possession of the husband because he's entitled to the leasehold. He can get the property. But when she sold the rights of the principal, she owns those, and once she passes away, they should revert to the person who she sold them to. She owned the principal. She has the right to sell the principal. If she sold it before she passed away, then at the time of death, it should revert to that buyer rather than to the husband himself. So Gemara says over here, in Usha, they were metakein that when a woman sells Nichsei Malug b'chayi bala while her husband's still alive, umait, and then she predeceases her husband, abam motzi miyad l'kuchot, that the husband can go and take it away from the l'kuchot. Why can the husband take it away from the l'kuchot? If the husband is solely viewed as a yoresh, as an inheritor of his wife, then he's only now got rights to the property now, and the woman already sold it. His wife sold it prior to this point in time. So l'keach has the first lien on the property, he should be the one, the buyer should be the one to get the property. On the other hand, if we classify the husband as a lokeach, as a buyer, when he marries his wife, it's as if he's bought this property as part of the marriage, as part of the ketubah, he's bought this property. If that's the case, then the husband actually has the first right or first lien over here because he purchased it before anybody else did. I mean, at the time of the ketubah, at the time of the marriage, he purchased this property if his wife predeceases him, and therefore any lukuchot that purchased it afterwards are subsequent to his purchase. And that's why in Usha they were metakein that the husband gets to keep the property, he can go to seize it from the lukuchot, because he is the first lokeach over here. Here's the first buyer. Obviously, that buyer has a claim against the woman or against the estate, against the husband, for the money, so he could give the money and he'll get the property back, but the husband is entitled to the property. So here we prove that a husband is a lokeach, and the implications of a husband being a lokeach, meaning being a buyer from his wife, in terms of the property, is that, number one, he's not obligated to return it if the property was seized on behalf of the woman for when she was a creditor before they were married. And number two is that if she was a debtor before they married and property was seized from her, he can't come in and redeem that property on behalf of his wife because he doesn't step into her shoes. He's rather lokech. He's simply a buyer over here. Now the Gemara queries about a different instance. What about Agbe Yehu B'chovo? What happens if they don't go to court? The creditor and debtor don't go to court, and there's no seizure of the property by the court on behalf of the creditor, but rather the creditor comes to the debtor and says, you owe me money, it's time to pay up, and the debtor says, I have no money. So the creditor says, okay, then give me your property. And the debtor agrees, he acquiesces to give the property to him. What's the din of this property once he's given it to him? Now, later on, month later, 2 months, a year later, the debtor comes into money, says, listen, I want my property back. Here's the money that I owed you. What's the din? So, ad ve'yu b'chovo, the creditor took the property without going to Beis Din, but with an agreement between the debtor and the creditor, they agreed, took the property instead of the loan. Pligi ba revach of ravina, machlokas. Chadamar hadra, one of them says that we do return the property to the debtor, but chadamar lo hadra. One says no. Why? So mandamar lo hadra, the one who says we do not return the property, savar, he holds haizvine ma'al yahu. This was a complete sale. Right, this was a fair and clean sale. The debtor agreed to give the property to the creditor. I mean, as opposed to when it's in Beis Din, the Beis Din comes and seizes the property that's against the will of the debtor. He had no choice, but that's what Beis Din did, it against his will. Then we can say when he comes into money that he can buy back the property that was seized. On the other hand, here, the debtor willingly gave the property to the creditor. Not, it wasn't seized from him. He said, okay, in lieu of payment, I'm giving the property to close out the loan. If he did that, then it's equivalent to a sale. I mean that the creditor is forgiving the loan as a compensation for purchasing the land from the debtor. If that's the case, this is a full-fledged sale, and the sale should be upheld. Manda Amar Hadra, the one who says no, that the debtor has the right to get it back. Savar lo zvinei ma'al yahu. It's not really a true sale. Why? V'hayda agve midate. But didn't he willingly enter the sale? Velata the Dina, well, why did he allow it to go through when he was a willing participant and then go to Beis Din? Machla kisufo da agbe. The reason that he gave it up here is not because he's a willing participant, rather because he's too embarrassed. He's embarrassed. He doesn't want to be dragged to court, have the seizure be done in court, and have them to do the auction, make a whole public deal out of it. He'd rather just give the property and keep it quiet than go to court and be a whole big public affair. So the reason that he's selling the property is not, again, willingly or out of his own volition, but rather because he's being forced. He's in a situation where he has to choose between embarrassment or giving up the property. And in that case, he chooses to give up the property. So the mechira, again, is under duress. If it's under duress, then we allow him, when he comes into money later, to buy that property back because it was a sale under duress. And a sale under duress, we say, vasita yashar v'tov. The right thing to do in that case is if the person gets the money back to return the property, as we saw in the previous amud. Now, the Gemara asks the question, from what point in time is the creditor entitled to start eating the peirot or the output of this property? Meaning that if the debtor is unable to pay and we are seizing his property by the Beis Din, from which point in time does that seizure of property then move into the creditor's possession? So we have a three-way machloket over here. Rabba Amar Michimacha Adrachta Liade. Adrachta is the actual seizure document that Beis Din writes, and it says that and if this debtor has property anywhere, you can take this document and then bring it to the court with and say, look, I found property that belongs to the debtor, I want it seized. So that's what the Adrachta is. So the Rabba believes that until you've received that document of seizure, you're not allowed to eat, it's not yours. You can't eat from the debtor's property once you've found it. Abaye Amar Idav b'chutma v'zachin lo. So we saw this opinion of Abaye earlier on in the Masechta. Abaye believes that once the Edim sign on the document, that makes it effective. So the seizure document, once the Edim have signed on the seizure document, that makes it effective immediately, and it doesn't have to actually reach the creditor's hands. As soon as it's signed, that seizure document makes it as if it's in the creditor's possession. If it's in the creditor's possession, then he could start eating the payroll to the field. And the last opinion we have is Rava Amar Michi Shalimale Yimei Achrazta. That no, that you're too early on in the process. The seizure document's fine. That only allows him to go out and then seize the property. And then he has to bring that to Beis Din and tell him that we found the property. And then Beis Din auctions off the property, which is Yimei Achrazta. There's an auction process by which they liquidate this property and they give the money to the creditor. So Rava says, no, that the malveh only comes into possession of the item after they've auctioned the property off. Until they auction the property off, then it really doesn't belong to the creditor. Creditor, yes, he has a seizure document. He can go seize the property, but he still requires Beis Din to do an auction process and to assess what the value of this property is. And once they've done that, then he gets paid out of it. So until that process is through, until the process of auctioning has gone through, then it's not classified as the creditor's property. Tosfos here discusses the possibility and brings another girsa to deal with the steer of Rava somewhere else, that maybe Rava, the opinion that we assigned to Rabba is really Rava's opinion, and we switched around. It'll be Rava, Abaye, and then Rabba, instead of the way we have, which is Rabba, Abaye, and Rava. Okay, now, the next Mishnah, this is the second Mishnah, very interesting case here in Amafgid, which is Asucher Para Michaviro. Someone rented a cow from his friend, V'ishila Lechem. And after he had rented the cow, he actually lends it out to another party. Umeita Kedarka. And then it died a natural death. Now, what's the din of a socher? The din of a socher is like that of a shomer sachar, which is that If he has gneva aveda, he'll be chayav. If it's onus, if it's something that's out of control, then he'll be patur. On the other hand, what's the din of a shoel? A shoel is chayav in all things, even onsin. He's required to pay back everything to the balim except for meta machmat melacha, unless it dies while he's using it, because otherwise, what's the purpose of the shoel barring if he can't use it? So meta machmat melacha, that'll be the only time he's patur. So now we have a case here, which is meta kedarka. The animal died a natural death. Natural death is considered to be an onus. So as far as the socher and his relationship with the balim, with the original owners, as far as he's concerned, he's patur now. He's patur because there's an onis, and his socher is patur. On the other hand, the shoel, who borrowed it from the socher, the shoel borrows it from the socher, okay, is chayav in onsin. So now he has to pay the socher. He must pay the socher. So what's going to happen here is the socher is going to get money from the shoel, but the balim will get no money because the socher doesn't owe them any money. So Rabbi Yossi asked the obvious question. So he says, well, we hear the Gemara, the Tanakam includes the Shavah Socher, Shemeta Kedarka. The Socher takes the Shavuah to be poter himself that was Meta Kedarka because it's Onis, which is entitled to, Vashalu Yishalim Socher. The Shavuah will pay the Socher, so the Socher actually will make money with someone else's property. And that's what Amar Biosi. Ketzad Hala Usa Schora Bekaparato Shel Chavero. How could it be that the Socher is making money with this other guy's property? He's someone else's property, and now he's making money. He's making out like a bandit here. He, the Socher, now gets a full payment for a full cow now. And he gets to keep that money. And the Balim, who are the ones who actually rented it to him in the first place and gave him the ability to lend it out, right, they're out everything. They get no money back at all. Doesn't make sense. El taksur para the Balim. But rather, the Shoel, if he's going to pay, he should pay it back straight back to the Balim because they're the rightful owners of this para over here. So the Gemara says, Amalei Rav Idi bar Avner Abayi, Michte, Socher b'may koni lahai para. How does the socher own the para? Meaning that when does he come into possession of the para that the shoel is going to pay him, that the person he lent to is now going to compensate him as the balim, as the owners? So the assumption here is Amalei Rav Idi bar Avner Abayi is because bishvuah, that the what transfers the ownership from the balim to the socher is once he takes the shvuah. He gets up and says it was meta machmat atzma, it was meta kedarka, it was a natural death, it died a natural death, and therefore I'm patur, I'm onis, I'm patur here. At that moment, the animal transfers from the balim over to the shomer. Then when the shoel shows up, he's going to pay this socher. The name alei maskir the socher. So if this is the case, that the shoel is what generates that change in ownership, let the maskir, the original balim, say to the socher, dal ant v'dal shvuatich. I'm not interested in you. I'm not interested in your shvuah. Don't take your shvuah. The shvuah is for me. I don't want your shvuah. But I'm standing dine behind the shvuah, and I'll go directly to the shvuah, and I will bring him to court. I mean, I don't need you the socher. I don't need you over here. If you take the shvuah, then you're going to take possession of my property. I don't need that. Keep your shvuah. Don't make a shvuah, and then I will go and deal with the shvuah myself. So they answer, Amalei misvarat socher b'shvuah. Who says that you're right? Who says that it's the shvuah itself that's what generates the ownership of the socher here? Maybe mishat mitahu dekani. That truthfully, at the moment the animal dies, at that moment it goes into possession of the socher. Since the socher is patur from compensating the balim, the moment it dies, the socher now is in possession or ownership of this animal. Ushvuah. So then, why is he taking a shvuah that it died but onus? Why does he have to give any shvuah if it's in his possession? Right? Why does he take a shvuah? It's because the happy that toshu balabayit is in order to relax or calm the nerves of the owner, the original owner, meaning that he should be trustworthy. This socher should be believed that it really did die a natural death. So we say to him, please take a shvuah. It is yours now. You're right. But please take a shvuah to ease the mind of the balim, the original owners, to know that you didn't really take it for yourself or steal it or do something else that was pshia with it. Take a shvuah that it was actually an ones, and therefore you are patur over here. Tosfos over here explains the machlokas of Rabbi Yossi and the Tanakam and the Mishnah, not simply like what you would believe is that Rabbi Yossi believes that since the socher is coming into possession of money from the shoel, and why is the shoel paying the socher money? Is because of the para, because of that cow that was lost. So really, he gets a cow back. And if he gets a cow back, then he should have to give that cow to the maskir. He should have to give it to the original owner. That's not the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi, but rather the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi is, as we've just explained in the Gemara here, that the machlokas between the Tana Kama and Rabbi Yossi, according to Tosfos, is this machlokas that we just saw in the Gemara between Rabbi Yossi and Avin and Abayi, about when does the socher come into possession of the item. Rabbi Yossi believes that the individual only comes in, the socher only comes into possession of the item after the shvuah. Since it only comes into possession after the shvuah, you can say to him, forget the shvuah, I don't want the shvuah, and the balim can go directly to the shoel. On the other hand, the chachamim, or the Tanakama, believes in our Mishnah that the item goes into possession of the socher at the time of death, at the time of mitah, and because it goes into possession at the time of mitah, Therefore, the Shvua here, he doesn't have a right to reject the Shvua. The Shvua is not the item that's taken into possession of the Socher. And since it's already in the possession of the Socher, when the Shvua pays, he pays directly to the Socher. So the machlokus between the Tana Kamo and Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah will be exactly these two different deot that we just saw in the Amoraim in the Gemara, but not simply what we would have thought, which is, well, how could he make, if the Shvua is paying the Socher for the Parah, that means that he's returning a Parah, and that Parah should go back to the Baalim. So that's how Tosus explains the Gemara over here. Tosus also points out, because of that, if that really is the reason of Rabbi Yossi is about the Shvua here, then it must be a case, the only case where the Maskir, or the Baalim, can go after the Shoel, is in a case where he can push the Socher out of the case and say, I don't need you. So that would be in a case where either the Socher decides he wants to take a Shvua, he can say, listen, I don't want your Shvua, or even in a case where the Socher is bringing Edim to the fact that it died Machmat Onis. Over there, you can also say, the Maskir, the Baalim can say, don't bring the Edim, I'm not interested in your Edim. But in a case where the Maskir himself, where the Baalim themselves were there when the animal died, then he couldn't cut the Socher out of the picture, because he doesn't need the Socher to tell him that it died by Onis. It died by Onis because he was present there. If that's the case, then he can't cut the Socher out of the picture. And Rabbi Yossi would have to agree in that case. The way Tosus explained their Machlokas here, Rabbi Yossi would have to agree in that case that you compensate the Shoel pays the Socher and stays with the Socher, because there's no longer this ability of the Baalim to knock the Socher out of the picture. Okay, now the last case here, we'll finish up the daf, is Amar Bzeira, Pamim Shabalim Mishalmim Kama Parot the Socher. You have this unbelievable case where a Baalim can actually pay a number of cows to someone who's renting for them. What's the case? Hechi dami. Agamine meayomi. You had a socher, you have a renter come along and rent it from the owners for 100 days. Vahadar shayle mine tishin yomim. The owners come back to them. So Ruvain owns a para here, and he rents it out to Shimon for 100 days. Then he comes back to Shimon and says, listen, no, I really need it back. I know you're renting it, but can I borrow it back for 90 days? He says, sure, you're back. Go ahead. Borrow it for 90 days. And that's what Ruvain does. He borrows it for 90 days from Shimon. So then he'll keep it for 9 days, bar for 9 days, and the last 10 days I'll have to give it back to him so that he can do the skirut for him. Then Hadar Agramine Tamin Yumin. Then Shimon comes back and says, look, I know I lent it to you, but I really need it back to rent. So I'm gonna rent it from you for 80 days now. So what will happen? He says, I'll rent it for 80 days. So then he'll be entitled to use it for the 80 days. He'll have to give 10 days back to the Shoel to use for that 10 days, and then he'll get it back for another 10 days to finish up his first rental. But Hadar Shalomine Shivin Yumin. And then Reuben comes back and says, listen, I know I rented it to you a second time, but I really need to borrow it back, and I'm going to borrow it back for 70 days. So now in that case, he will have it in his possession for the 70 days. Then he'll give it to the Socher to use for 10 days. Then he'll get it back as a borrowed item for 10 days, and then he'll give it back to the Socher to use for 10 days. But what happens? While it was with the original owner, who is now borrowing the item, it dies. It dies. Dies when he is in possession of it. The Acha Akol Sheila V'Sheila Mechayiv Chadapara. That the Shoel, who's the borrower here, the owners happen to be the borrower, but based on our Mishnah, who says when a Socher gives it out to the Shoel, who's entitled to payment in the Tanakama? The Socher. So now the Socher, who's Shimon over here, is now entitled to payment of two parot. He lent it twice. He lent it the first time, and then he lent it the second time. He lent it to Reuven, even though Reuven's the owner, but he lent it to him. Now Reuven, as the Shoel, is now obligated to pay the Socher, Shimon, to a replacement parah, to pay him for the onus that happened. So therefore, the Shoel, first time, he'll pay him one parah for the second time that he borrowed it for 70 days, and he'll pay him another parah for the first time that he borrowed to him for 90 days. So now the Socher will end up with two parot. In addition to that, he'll have to buy, Reuven will have to buy an additional two parot to fill in the 10 days of Schirut, the two types of rentals that he had before. So actually you have to have four parot over here. Two parot he'll have to give to the Socher, and the Socher will keep, which is amazing here. The Socher, the animal originally belonged to the owner, and nevertheless, because of their relationship now, he's going to have to actually give two parot. He's out his parah, and he's going to have to give, in addition to being out his parah, he has to give two parot to the Socher, to Shimon. And on top of that, he'll have to buy or purchase an additional two parot to allow Shimon to do his schirut. He's still entitled to 10 days of schirut from the second schirut and 10 days of schirut from the first schirut. So he'll have to buy him two animals to do the schirut of those 10 days, and then Shimon will give it back to Reuven. So you have four parot here. Two of them will stay with Shimon. Two of them will go to Shimon to finish out his chirut and go back to Reuven. And then Reuven's out. He's actually now purchased four parot. He's out the original parot. He's paid for five parot, in a sense. And he's only getting two of them back. And this the Shimon, who's the renter, is actually getting these marviach. He ends up with two parot. So now, Amar Rav Acha Midifti, he says, wait a minute. If you're going to say that, But if you're going to say Kol Shela V'Shela Mechayev Chadapara, I'm going to Ravacha Midifti Ravina Michtei Chadaparahi. We're only talking about one object over here. It's true that there was two lendings over here, but the fact is that it was all about this single object, this one para. Ayla V'Afka. So it's going in, it's going out. It's the same object that's being transacted with each time. Afka mischirut va'ayla l'shela. He leaves the, you know, rental and he's giving it as the loan. Afka mishela, and then when he rents it back again, it leaves the shela and goes to the schirut and back and forth. But it's still a single object that's moving back and forth. How could you say there's multiple shelot over here, that there's multiple borrowings or multiple rentings over here? It's really the same object that's being transacted with. So he responded to him. No, Rabbi Zera says, no, that's not the case. Umi ita the par be'ena, the name of Lehachi. He says, true, if the object was still extant, if the object was still around here, we could make your claim, which is that there's one para. If there's one para, we can move it back and forth. But the case is here is that he has to compensate. When we're talking about compensation or money, money does not replace the para. It does not become like the object or that the para was. Here, if we had the para and we had the object here, then he could use that para to fill in, to return for both shelot, and he could use that single para for both schirut to allow him to work it and use it as for the schirut. Problem is that we don't have the para anymore. When he pays or he compensates for the para, that's not the equivalent of the original object. That is tachlif, that is a replacement for the object, but not the object itself. If that's the case, then in each instance, he's going to have to pay for each instance he should have gotten the object. And that's why he's entitled to two parim here for the two shelot, and not getting a single parb, even though it was one object originally, but they're two different shelot. So Rav Ashi comes back and says, Rav Ashi says, no. He says, Rav Ashi Amar, now he's basically supporting the position of Rav Acham Bidifti and saying, there are only two cows have to be here. Before we said four, he's saying two. Why? Chada de shela v'chada de schirut. One for the loans and one for the rentals. Shum shela achati v'shum schirut achati. Now when we're talking about multiple transactions, but multiple transactions about the same object, then everything within a certain classification will be considered one. Therefore, when it comes to the loans, all the loans, or the relationship between Rivka and Shimon is a single relationship. Because it was about one object, therefore the multiple lendings don't manifest themselves as two different transactions. It's a single transaction. I borrowed the same object from you, which means that there's only one basic category of Shela, and he rented it from you, so there's one category or relationship between us of schirut, of renting, even though it manifested itself in multiple actual, you know, back and forth between us, but nevertheless, since there was only one object involved, we'll classify them all as one area. Sheila, all borrowings, and all schirut will be classified as one area. And therefore, in this case, our case of Reuven Shimon, Reuven will only have to purchase two cows over here. He have to purchase one cow because he borrowed a cow from Shimon. When he borrowed from Shimon, now he's obligated in Unsim. He has to pay Shimon the cow back. So he'll have to give one cow to Shimon. He'll buy an additional cow, which he'll give to Shimon to use for his schirut, because he still owes him 20 days of the rental period time. So buy one cow, he'll give it to Shimon to use for those 20 days, and then it'll return to him. So in this case, he'll be out three cows, in a sense. Reuven will be out three cows. He lost his original cow. Plus, he'll have to purchase two new cows. One of those cows he'll give to Shimon, and he'll keep for all the borrowings that he did with him about the original cow. And he'll give the other up cow that he has, he'll give it to him to finish out the schirut, the rental that he's entitled to those 20 days, and then he'll get it back. So Reuven will be left with one cow out of the three that he paid for, the original one plus the additional two. And then Shimon will now end up being Marviach, end up benefiting by one cow. He'll get an extra cow to his name, because in the beginning he never owned any cows. Now that he had rented it, he'll get the rental finished out. That's fine. We buy him a cow to do that. But in addition to that, he'll keep an additional cow. Just like our Mishnah says over here, the relationship between a socher and a shoel, that if a socher might be patur from paying the balim back, here Shimon's the socher, so he's patur from giving anything to Reuven. On the other hand, Reuven, the original owner, is the one who shoel is borrowing it from Shimon, and then his relationship from the shoel to the socher is he's got to pay the socher. He's got to give the money to the socher. In this case, it means he has to give a para to the original owners. Okay, we'll stop over here and continue with the Gemara tomorrow.